And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Could this be it? I mean, might this be it? Scott McClellan now. We mentioned this yesterday. In fact, it was the subject of our progressive pop quiz. I wouldn't say we hammered it, but we certainly got into it. That Scott McClellan has now come out and fingered George W. Bush and Dick Cheney as being directly involved in the cover-up. And to quote actually Chris Matthews, the circle was closed. And a tip of the hat to him, by the way, doing his entire show yesterday on this story as it was developing in the afternoon after we got off the air. I was, and then Keith Olbermann picked the thing up. The thing that, here's the bottom line. The story is that Scott McClellan, the second press secretary in the Bush administration, who was press secretary when the Valerie Plame Wilson story was breaking, Scott McClellan is writing a book, which will be out in April, and has dropped this bombshell that Bush and Cheney lied to him, along with Andy Card and Karl Rove, lied to him and Scooter Libby about their involvement in outing Valerie Plame and covering it up. So he, in other words, became part of the cover-up. Now, let's keep in mind that, you know, Bush had talked about this. I mean, Bush had here's for example, one.
This is a town of where a lot of people leak. And I've constantly expressed my displeasure with leaks, particularly leaks of classified information. And I want to know. I want to know the truth. I want to see to it that the truth prevails. I'd like to know if somebody in my White House did leak sensitive information. As you know, I've been outspoken on leaks. Whether they happened in the White House or happened in the administration or happened on Capitol Hill, they can be very damaging. And so this investigation is ongoing and by professionals who do this for a living, and I'd like to know.
Now, oddly, in those two cases, he was talking about who leaked the information about his spying on Americans, his spying on other people, his spying perhaps on the Democratic Party. But when it came to the leaking of the information about Valerie Plame...
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he doesn't have any idea. Well, it turns out that he apparently did have any idea. He did know what was going on. Now, the question, of course, on everybody's mind, actually, is did he know what was going on, or was he as in the dark as McClellan? In other words, we know that this thing, now, from testimony in the Patrick Fitzgerald investigation of Scooter Libby, the prosecution of Scooter Libby, we know that it apparently originated with Dick Cheney, making margin notes on the New York Times article. We also know that George W. Bush expressed an interest as soon as the New York Times reported. This was before Joe Wilson published his op-ed, that George W. Bush had expressed an interest. What an amazing thing, that a curiosity on the part of George W. Bush. But this was the testimony at the trial. Had expressed an interest in knowing who might be that person who was going to challenge his assertion that there was uranium in Niger that was going to Saddam Hussein. And now we have Scott McClellan coming out and saying, these guys lied. These guys, well, here's the exact quote. He said, the most powerful leader in the world had called upon me to speak on his behalf. Now, keep in mind, he's talking about Bush here. This isn't about, you know, gee, I was lied to by Karl Rove. Or say, well, here's the whole quote anyway. We'll put it, let you calculate the context. The most powerful leader in the world had called upon me to speak on his behalf and help restore credibility he lost amid the failure to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So I stood at the White House briefing room podium in front of the glare of the Klieg lights for the better part of 2 weeks and publicly exonerated the two senior most aides in the White House, Karl Rove and Scooter Libby. There's only one problem. It was not true. I had unknowingly passed along false information, and five of the highest-ranking officials in the administration were involved in my doing so. Rove, Libby, the vice president, the president's chief of staff, that would be Andy Card, and the president himself, that would be George W. Bush. Now, there are a couple of things that I find absolutely amazing about this. First of all, keep in mind, Nixon was not impeached for the crime of Watergate. That was not it was a piece of it. But the big issue that led to Nixon's impeachment was the cover-up of the crime of Watergate. And here we have Scott McClellan saying that Bush was involved in the cover-up of this, in hiding this, in lying to his own press secretary. And then Bush pardons or commutes the sentence of Scooter Libby. He didn't give him a full pardon. That'll probably happen when he leaves office. But he commuted his sentence so Scooter Libby would not have to serve any time in jail after he was convicted by a jury of his peers of the felony of perjury and obstruction of justice. Patrick Fitzgerald saying that the obstruction of justice that was committed by Scooter Libby threw sand in the umpire's eyes, to quote Patrick Fitzgerald, the prosecutor in this thing, so that he couldn't see who was really behind outing the CIA operative Valerie Plame. And here we have Valerie Plame Wilson, who is on record, and certainly people around her who can speak about some of the materials redacted from her new book, but she talked about this on this program some months ago, maybe some weeks ago, is on record as saying that she was working in the realm of counterproliferation. I mean, here was a CIA operation, Brewster Jennings. This was a program that was designed to find out who were the bad guys who were trying to get nuclear weapons, and it had to do with Iraq and Iran, among others. They had operations all around the world, and as soon as her name was leaked out, you can bet, if people didn't die, they certainly changed their identities in a hurry. Their careers were destroyed. The U.S. intelligence was set back. I mean, this was treason, to quote George Bush Sr. Outing a CIA officer is treason. Covering it up is a felony. So here we have the former press secretary to the president, which I would put, in kind of the same category as the lawyer to the president, in as much as he's close to the president, he's a major aide to the president, he should be, relatively speaking anyway, a confidant of the president, or vice versa. And it was the lawyer for Nixon, John Dean, who talked about the cancer on the presidency before Congress, who basically spilled the beans that Nixon knew about this thing and was covering it up, that led to Nixon's impeachment. And here you have the press secretary to George Bush spilling the beans, saying that Bush knew about it and that he was covering it up and that, basically he was lying to us. Apparently he was lying to us when...
And I don't know if we're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Well, and now we do know, at the very least, that it was Cheney and Libby and Rove. We know that from testimony in the prosecution of Scooter Libby. And Bush had later said he would hold them accountable. Now, that's half of the amazing part of this. The other half of the amazing part of it, and frankly, this is the part that amazes me even more, and frankly, it plays in perfectly to the second hour of our program, where we're going to have Eli Lehrer from the Competitive Enterprise Institute on telling us how wonderful it is that media gets bigger and bigger and better, and maybe just one company should own all the media in the United States, is that the Washington Post, the New York Times, I mean, I've got USA Today here, it's on page 7, a little story buried down next to Bush's pardoning the turkey. In fact, that's the photo that goes along with it, is Bush pardoning the turkey. McClellan writes he was misinformed in Plame affair. That the so-called mainstream media, with a singular exception of what I saw on MSNBC last night, the mainstream media seems to be ignoring, and or might we say burying, a story that, frankly, 30 years ago, in my opinion, would have led to the directly to the impeachment of the President of the United States. So the question is, what is the media going to do with this thing? And what are the Democrats in Congress going to do with this thing? When we come back from the break, I just want to go through a short list of what many suggest are the impeachable offenses of Bush and Cheney, of this administration. And now this. And then we'll take your call, 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
You're a chicken, and I'm a turkey. And here is my love song, just to you. I love your wings. I love your beak. You do those things. They're so unique. I love your eyes, the way you walk. I love your voice, the way you squawk.
It's the turkey's love song, yes. And happy Thanksgiving, by the way, tomorrow coming up. Many things for all of us to be thankful for. Among them, that we still live in a nation where we can discuss these things. The rationales for impeachment, the things that George W. Bush has done and covered up successfully or you know, lied about for that matter. For example, let's just start with the warrantless surveillance of Americans. The Fourth Amendment of the Constitution is quite explicit. I mean, it's not even remotely ambiguous. This is the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. Against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue except but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized, period, end of sentence, end of Fourth Amendment. No warrant shall issue. Everyone shall be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures. It shall not be violated, the right of the people to be secure. And Bush, you know, initially tried to lie his way out of that one. I mean, it's...
Now, by the way, anytime you hear the United States government talking about wiretap, a wiretap requires a court order. Nothing has changed, by the way. When we're talking about chasing down terrorists, we're talking about getting a court order before we do so. It's important for our fellow citizens to understand, when you think Patriot Act, constitutional guarantees are in place when it comes to doing what is necessary to protect our homeland because we value the Constitution.
Lying through his teeth. I mean, just quite simply, lying through his teeth. And later when he's caught on it?
There's a process that goes on inside the Justice Department. And I presume about leaks. I presume that process is moving forward. My personal opinion is it was a shameful act for someone to disclose this very important program in time of war.
This is his warrantless wiretapping. Somebody exposed him.
The fact that we're discussing this program is helping the enemy.
Yeah.
You got to understand. And I hope the American people understand, there is still an enemy that would like to strike the United States of America, and they're very dangerous.
In other words, be afraid, we'll do away with the Constitution, just like Musharraf did. You know, after all, Bush now is saying Musharraf hasn't stepped over any lines. Oh, yeah? So he's beaten and imprisoned his political opponents, he's put judges in jail, he's put lawyers in jail, he's gassed people, he's suspended the Constitution, he's taken the right upon himself to decide who can get elected and when, who can run for office and when. All of that is just fine with George W. Bush.
But it is a shameful act by somebody who has got secrets of the United States government and feels like they need to disclose them publicly.
Yeah, the secret being that George W. is illegally wiretapping us. And frankly, you know, I don't get why the Democrats are not saying, George, we want to know if you're listening in on our phone conversations the same way Richard Nixon did, because you're wiretapping illegally the same way Richard Nixon did. I mean, can you imagine what Newt Gingrich would do with this if he had discovered that Bill Clinton was wiretapping people?
Quick to detect and prevent. We use FISA still. You're referring to the FISA court.
He's lying here again.
But FISA's is for long-term monitoring. What is needed in order to protect the American people is the ability to move quickly to detect.
Which he always had.
Having suggested this idea, I then obviously went to the question, is it legal to do so? I swore to uphold the laws.
No, the Constitution.
Do I have the legal authority to do this? And the answer is absolutely. As I mentioned in my remarks, the legal authority is derived from the Constitution, as well as the authorization of force by the United States Congress.
Yeah, it's derived from the Constitution. I believe I read to you from the Constitution on that. So, number one, impeachable offense. Wiretapping Americans, violating the Fourth Amendment, and lying about it. And then when he got caught, lying about it even more. Number two, invading Iraq illegally. I mean, this is a preemptive war. This is a violation of numerous treaties which are now the law of our land. And the resolution that the Senate passed required Bush to write, within 60 days, to write a letter to Congress saying that Saddam Hussein was somehow directly involved in 9/11. And he did. And that letter's part of the public record. And it's a lie. The violations of the Geneva Conventions, torture, unlawful combatant status, extraordinary rendition, treatment of detainees, I mean, creating Guantanamo, obviously leaking classified information, outing a CIA agent, all of this information, not just outing a CIA agent, the yellow cake forgery, the CIA grand jury leaks, commuting the sentence of Scooter Libby. This, in my opinion, is an impeachable offense if it was done to prevent Libby from telling that Bush himself was complicit in criminal acts. I mean, I think that what we have here is something that is absolutely Nixonian in its proportion. Where is the media? 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Quick reminder here coming up November 29th. I'll be in Los Angeles at 7:30 at Barnes & Noble on the 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica. November 30th, Friday, we'll be at Oak Park, California, speaking at the Ventura County Democrats Speaker Series, 7 to 9 p.m. And on December 14th, I'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota, 7 p.m. at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at Kauffman Memorial Union. So here we have the President of the United States being fingered, outed, whatever the phrase is, revealed by his own press secretary as one of the liars around an act that his father referred to as treason, as a traitorous act. George W. Bush, who said...
So I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation... But I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. The Constitution is the decider. And that now we're discovering, now we've discovered the Downing Street minutes, for example, demonstrate that Bush was fully intending to have a war in Iraq, whether Blair went along with it or not, whether the UN went along with it or not, whether the inspectors went along with it or not.
You say we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq.
Liar.
I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah, another lie, another bald-faced lie. We know, for example, the inspectors were in Iraq. You had Hans Blix in Iraq who running around saying, you know, we're not finding anything. There's nothing here. You know, we're not finding anything at all.
You know, in the Middle Ages when people were convinced there were witches and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence. And I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
But he didn't have it. There was no evidence of it. And the inspectors were in that country right up until the day George Bush said, you guys leave because we're going to start dropping bombs. And he lied about that.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in.
Not true.
And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power, along with other nations, so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
This is just a bald-faced lie. I mean, at what point do the lies... Here's another one. Mr. Bush, have we found weapons of mass destruction?
We found the weapons of mass destruction. We found biological laboratories. But for those who say we haven't found the banned manufacturing devices or banned weapons. They're wrong. We found them.
Yeah, I don't recall a retraction on that. So, number one, where's the media? Number two, I mean, outside of, you know, the tip of the hat to the folks at Common Dreams and BuzzFlash and Arianna Huffington, the Huffington Post. I mean, they're great headlines, but where's the mainstream media on this? And a tip of the hat to Chris Matthews and Keith Olbermann, who did a great job with this last night on their programs. But it seems like everybody else has gone missing. From Steve Young's piece over in the Huffington Post and at opednews.com, he's quoting, he says, Rush Limbaugh, so McClellan is a proven liar. Why would we believe anything he says? McClellan admits that he was lying to us because he was lied to, and therefore we should not listen to him because apparently he lied to us. Go figure. Ed in Hillsboro, Oregon. Hey, Ed.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Well, you know, this is the smoking gun for this administration. A member of the Inner Circle has come out and it revealed that they were lying about committing treason.
Yes.
And, you know, we need to become the media this Thanksgiving. And when we gather with our friends and family, we need to let them all know, if they don't know already, what's going on. And we need to make a concerted effort, each of us with our social circle, with our family, to get the word to Congress that this is enough, and they've got to begin impeachment proceedings.
Yeah, very well said, Ed. Thank you very much. Jim in Flushing, Michigan. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Tom. A couple of quick points. First, you and most people still refer to Time Magazine and CNN and all of that as the mainstream media. They're not really mainstream. They're the traditional media.
They're actually the corporate media these days.
Okay. Actually, I have a different name for it that relates back to the acronym for the Soviet Union, but I won't get into that. The more outrageous point about what McClellan said is not that it's not currently being reported, what he said, and the implications of that. If you think back to it, when he was in fact peddling those lies, there were at least six members of the media that were sitting there in that audience who knew he was lying. But yet, what did they do? They peddled the lies.
You're talking about the ones who were then subpoenaed to testify in the Scooter Libby case, like Tim Russert and is that the point that you're making, all these folks?
You got Tim Russert, you got Matt Cooper, you got Judy Miller, and you had at least three others that we know about, if you want to believe what Bob Novak wrote. So these people were actually sitting there. They knew that our government was lying to us, and that they were being used to peddle those lies, and yet they agreed to do it. I mean, it's not just treason by our government. It's treason by the Fourth Estate, which is the only, as you've told us so many times, the only industry, the only profession that is mentioned in our Constitution or the Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
And I mean, they have so completely skewed that, and yet now you've got this guy who's the head of the FCC who sat through the outrageous meeting in Portland that I saw a little bit of coverage on and that you have talked about, as if people there and everything they said was simply not said.
Yeah, yeah. You're absolutely right, Jim. Thank you for pointing that out. George Bush, again, in his State of the Union address.
First, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
And at the time, he knew that it was a lie.
Facing clear evidence of peril.
Clear evidence.
We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
And Scott McClellan, you know, Ellen Ratner is a regular on this program in the Talk Radio News Service. She knows Scott quite well. Her comment to me is he's a guy of integrity, and he just couldn't look himself in the mirror anymore. He had to come out and say this. And I'll tell you, as an author, if you have a book coming out in April, you don't promote it in the previous November. You don't promote it 5-6 months in advance, because it'll kill a book. By the time the book comes out, it's lost. You promote the book. I mean, if you're going to drop leaks from a book, you do it a month before the book comes out, and that starts the news cycle, so that people go in and they pre-order the book and all that kind of thing. But you don't do it 5-6 months out. This is Scott McClellan trying to clear his name. This is Scott McClellan pointing out the lies here. Jim in Anaheim, California. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom. How are you? I just wanted to reinforce your statement about the media failing us. Just minutes before I heard it on the radio, you discussing where they'd place some of these, I had a discussion with a friend about the fact the Los Angeles Times, a supposed liberal newspaper, had placed the McClellan article on page 20, two
right.
short columns.
Bottom right-hand front, corner.
Yeah, and on the front page of the Times, they had the seven munchkins remaining. The seven remaining munchkins were being honored in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way our media has gone. And in the past, as you know, the LA Times would have used the word treason right in their big 6-7-inch banner headline.
Yep. It's all infotainment all the time now. You're spot on right, Jim. Thank you. Bill in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Tom. I thought the most amazing thing about this when I opened the paper this morning was Dana Perino's comment. Well, it's not quite clear what Scott McClellan is saying. Well, you know, the president, and then in so many words to say, you know, the president doesn't lie. And I mean, and you look right above her comment in the story, and a direct quote from Scott McClellan's book that Bush was included in on this lie.
Right.
It's just,
yeah.
It's, they
well, Dana Perino, you know, she has the same job Scott did. I mean, her job, she's a professional spinner, and at least what she's saying isn't an explicit lie. It's more like a deflection, or it's a, you know, no droids in this car, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, yes, absolutely. But you wouldn't expect her to say it, but you would expect a journalist to say it. I mean, where are the Bob Woodwards of our day? Thank you, Bill. I appreciate the call. Mike in New York City. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how you doing? I have a couple of questions, Tom, if you can answer them for me.
Go for it.
All right. The first question is, will Nancy Pelosi now put impeachment back on the table?
I cannot answer for Nancy Pelosi.
And will Ron Paul's momentum now pick up now that you have the book out and everyone knows the truth? Who's going to have the cojones to stand up and say it?
Yeah, I think that, frankly, on the Republican side, Mike, I think that this is going to help Mike Huckabee more than it's going to help Ron Paul. Because Huckabee has already, you know, he jumped on this thing. He was on Matthew's, I'm sorry, your phone is breaking up. He jumped on this thing last night. He was on Matthew's show. He said, this is breathtaking. He said, boy, it's a bad time to have a Washington, D.C. address. He's positioning himself as the outsider. He's positioning himself as the Republican who can come in and clean up the mess created by, you know, this new Nixon. This, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. Only, frankly, the things that George W. Bush has done, his signing statements, another impeachable offense, the things that Bush has done are things that Nixon never would have even considered. Nixon was just the, you know, the simple stuff of spying on your enemies. I mean, this goes so far beyond that. Well, the Pentagon Papers lying about Vietnam, I suppose, lying to us about his secret plan to end the war to get reelected. There are some startling parallels, aren't there? Except that the press is paying no attention.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Put you like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug. I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Ooh, ooh. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Welcome back to Listener Supported Radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting us by patronizing our advertisers, our sponsors. First of all, listening for the sponsors on your local station, in particular, supporting your local sponsors, and also our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, sacredgroundscoffee.com, their website, Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX or smalldog.com. And the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Donna in Pasadena, California. You are on the air, Donna. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Keith had John Dean on last night, and John said he thought, you know, in regards to McClellan's statement, that Fitzgerald had kept it open. So my question is, do you think Fitzgerald will open this up again? And will Conyers and Leahy get some committee investigations going? What do you think?
I don't know. And this is what's so baffling to me, Don. I mean, I'm not a huge news organization with 35 or 3,500 or whatever reporters out there and bureau chiefs and people in Washington, D.C. and New York and whatnot, like the New York Times is, like the Washington Post is, like the ABC, CBS, NBC. And I fully expected, after having seen John Dean last night on Keith Olbermann's program and you know, laying out that Fitzgerald is still in business, I fully expected that this morning's New York Times, or even right now, I'd be able to go to NYTimes.com, and the top story would be something about whether or not Fitzgerald is going to be looking into this, you know, what the meaning of this is, what the significance of this is. Instead, I'm looking at the front page of the electronic edition of the New York Times, and the top story is Britain loses data for 25 million people. Why do I care about that?
Exactly.
The second is travelers' odds decline on airline baggage. Well, I suppose, you know, okay. The third, new method equalizes stem cell debate. Yeah, arguably. And you know, it's going into the handgun thing with the Supreme Court. But it's nowhere to be found here. I mean, it's probably buried someplace down, way, way down, but it's certainly nowhere near the top. And so I have to say, Don, I honestly don't know the answer to that question. And frankly, last night, I didn't think that I would have to go out and dig for it.
Exactly, and I think everybody should call their local papers and protest this, that they don't have it on, that they call the Washington Post, call the New York Times, call them all.
Yeah, I would like to know what's going on. I mean, that's the bottom line. Donna, thank you very much for the call. Mo in Manhattan.
Hey, Mo. I just want to say that a free press means that the press has the right to lie.
Certainly.
And not report information that has no obligations. If you look at the First Amendment, for example, it just says that a free press shall not be suppressed by Congress.
I absolutely agree with you, Mo. And here's my problem, is that we now have no longer a free press by virtue of monopoly.
How do you figure that?
Because you have, back, for example, when I was a kid growing up in Michigan, in Lansing, Michigan, there was the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News. One was the Democratic paper, one was the Republican paper. The one was the business paper, the other was the labor paper. The Democratic paper had a labor section, the Republican paper had a business section. Both of them would tell the same story through different lenses, and you knew what was going on. There were small local papers all over the country. Everybody knew the bias of the paper. That's the way it was in the United States for 200 years. When Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and in 87 when he stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine, but the real killer was 96 when Clinton passed the Telecommunications Act, and you started seeing this massive consolidation of media. I mean, the newspaper here in my hometown, Portland, Oregon, is owned by a corporation out of New York.
Well, isn't the corporation free to print what it wants?
It is.
Well, then it is free press.
It is not a free press.
Why
it
not?
Is because it's a monopoly, and monopolies are intrinsically anti-competitive.
Where do you get that idea?
Economics 101?
Economics 101 doesn't tell you. You could always have somebody coming along and breaking a monopoly. That's always happened.
Yeah, yeah. Good luck. You're going to take on General Electric?
Well, the point is, though, it's still really free because they have no right to even suppress a monopoly from printing what it wants if you have a free press. In the Soviet Union, for example, they did have rules against printing lies and things like that, only who decides what's a lie?
No, I am not arguing that anybody should be deciding what a lie is. And we'll be talking about media consolidation in the next hour, Mo. But I do believe that the media has an obligation to talk about what's really going on. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Well, I'm asking where it comes from. Where does this obligation come from?
From being protected in the Constitution. There is only one industry out of all the industries in the United States. I mean, the founders could have sat around and said, you know, cannonballs are really important, or bullets are really important. If we're going to survive and fight a war, we've got to have them. So let's protect that industry in the Constitution.
But what does it say?
The only industry that they chose to protect in the Constitution was the press in the First Amendment.
What does it say, though?
It says it shall be free and unfettered.
No, it says that Congress shall make no law suppressing a free press. That's what
right.
It says.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I totally agree with that. And what I am suggesting to you is that, number one, we no longer have a free press because of the media monopoly. And number two, because corporations have so much power in this country, they're afraid to lose their access to power. They're afraid to, you know, it's like we have one party. It's the money party. There's the Democratic wing of it and the Republican wing of it. And
well, did I use force?
But you're really getting into my argument for the next hour. My point here is, why do you think, Mo, that none of the national media are reporting on the fact that the press secretary to the President of the United States has implicated the President of the United States in an impeachable
offense? Why do I think it? Well, I'll tell you why. Because the newspapers tend to report what their usual readership wants to hear. And that way they get more advertising. You know, it's a business.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah. Well, that's that. All the more the tragedy, Mo. I'm sorry. Just all the more the tragedy. Rob in Orange County, California. Hey, Rob.
Oh, how are you? Thanks for taking my call. You know, I have a very simple point. 9/11 basically shook up the personalities of these people. You know, the media does not, they're all in fear, basically, of losing their jobs. They're afraid to lose their livelihood. How much does Tim Russert make? These people are afraid to tell the truth because of losing their jobs.
Yeah, and you've got millions of dollars on the table here.
Yeah,
millions of dollars on the table.
All right, thanks.
Good point. Thanks, Rob. We'll continue this conversation, only we'll take it in a slightly different direction. Coming up next, we're going to have Eli Lehrer. He's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, telling us that, hey, if only one corporation owned all the media. Well, actually, I'll just let him say it in his own words. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Eli Lehrer is with us. He is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Their website's CEI.org, where he directs CEI studies on insurance and credit markets. Eli, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you with us. You mentioned that we should identify the Competitive Enterprise Institute not as a conservative think tank, as I've done in the past, but as a libertarian think tank. Are you guys coming out in? I always refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. Are you guys coming out in favor of the legalization of prostitution and heroin? It's a serious question, actually.
Well, actually, speaking personally, the organizationally we focus on law and economics. Personally, I'd be fine with the legalization of prostitution, and in terms of heroin, I'd personally oppose that, but I'd suspect a lot of my colleagues would support it.
Yeah.
But neither of those are institutional positions.
Okay. So, since the organization deals with economics exclusively, is there a distinction between conservative and libertarian?
Oh, I very much say so, actually.
Okay.
Many conservatives want the government to prop up big corporations to work on the behalf of certain interests who they favor. Libertarians tend to favor the free market alone.
But that's the thing. If government gets out of the way entirely and you have totally laissez-faire economics, you're going to end up with basically in every industry one corporation or a very small monopolistic old boy network of corporations who own everything.
And, well, I disagree with that, but I don't favor the government getting out of the way entirely.
That's what history shows. I mean, you know, what you'll have is the British East India Company. It was a perfect example of what happens in a laissez-faire environment.
Well, that wasn't a laissez-faire environment at all. I'm actually glad you bring that up. The British East India Company was chartered and controlled as a mercantilist enterprise entirely by the authority of the British government, the British Parliament.
Well, all corporations
chartered, it was chartered directly. No, this was supported directly. It enjoyed special privileges that no other company had.
Well, yes and no. I mean,
that's a major difference, and you can't gloss that over.
The East India Corporation was chartered in December of
capitalism.
It was chartered in December 1601 by the Queen. And
call. I can barely hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry if you can't hear me, Eli. It's somebody will have to tweak that in New York, and I'll crank up my gain a little bit here.
Okay.
Maybe that'll help. In any case, without getting into the fundamentals of this, let's get to the topic that we're going to talk about.
Free market capitalism.
Yeah, let's get to the topic that we were going to talk about, which is there's a media monopoly. December 11th is the end date for people to let the FCC and presumably elected members of Congress who might have some influence with the FCC know how they feel about the government preventing further consolidation of media in the United States. In the absence of an antitrust, of the Sherman Antitrust Act, or variations thereof, the Federal Communications Act of what? It started in, I think, 27
the
and 35.
The Sherman Antitrust Act actually has nothing to say about media.
Fact, right, but, it's but except that media is a except that media is owned by corporations that would be subject to the Sherman Act, in theory.
Very indirectly. In fact, the Newspaper Preservation Act more or less exempts newspapers entirely from the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Okay, but then but we're looking at the laws that empowered that gave creation to the FCC back in the 20s, and that's really the bottom line here. And my question to you is, how can, since you're, you know, the first word of your think tank's name, Competitive Enterprise Institute, is competitive, how can a monopoly be competitive? What is competitive about a monopoly?
Monopolies exist in general only when the government authorizes or supports them. And particularly in the case of media markets, the current technology really makes these laws irrelevant.
So the fact that there's only one statewide newspaper in the state where I live now, Oregon, and it's owned by a corporation in New York State, that is because the government is making it that way?
No, but you're talking about, but is that the only way people could get news? Of course not. There's the Internet. There are dozens of other media. Newspapers.
Yeah, 20 years ago, there were five newspapers in this town.
It's quite appropriate in a declining market that there would be only one.
It's not a declining market. As Bill Moyers pointed out last week, the newspaper industry last year showed an average profit margin, after-tax profit margin of 17-18%, which is greater than the average for Fortune 500 companies.
Yes,
newspapers are doing very well, thank you very much.
They're profitable, but first, their margins have shrunk from their traditional thing. The number of newspapers has declined.
Hey, give me a 17% return. I'll take it any day of the week.
Also, in addition, that's pumped up enormously by a small number of newspapers. The general news, the average newspaper is getting a few points above what
so you see no danger to democracy, to small d democracy, if one corporation owns the newspaper in town, the radio station in town, the TV, or multiple radio stations in town, the TV station or TV stations in town, depending on the size of the city, obviously, see no danger to democratic discourse if that's the case.
Those regulations are no longer relevant given the technology we have. In a society where the only broadcasting you could get was basically, you know, within 40 miles of you, determined basically by the Earth's curvature, yeah, I could see a case for those laws. But where you get 220 cable channels, it essentially unlimited number.
90% of all the content on those 220 cable channels are coming from 13 companies, and you know that.
First, I don't think that's correct.
In terms of viewership, it absolutely is.
There's evidence, and there is none. There is none that ownership determines content. So you don't have any evidence.
I'll give you the example of Italy. I'm sure you're familiar with the story of Silvio Berlusconi. Here's this guy who's a small-time thug and businessman, and he's mobbed up, and he buys a newspaper. And then he buys a radio station, and then he buys a TV station, then he buys another radio station, then he buys another TV station, then he buys another newspaper, and then he buys a radio network, and then he buys a television network. And by the time he was done, he controlled 90% of the radio and television media and about 70% of the newspapers in the country of Italy, and then he ran for prime minister, and guess what? Surprise, surprise, he won! Is that what we want in the United States?
United States. The studies in the United States, which have been quite extensive, find basically no evidence for this happening. And I'm not going to comment specifically on the situation in Italy.
You've not read Ben Bagdikian's book, The Media Monopoly. You're not familiar with these arguments.
I've read it. I actually wrote an essay critiquing it. It's an extremely weak argument. His main evidence, his main quote for the only piece of evidence he has in that entire book is one quote about soap operas, which are owned outright by the soap companies and probably do promote a good impression of soap. Beyond that, there's just no evidence. There have been Edward Herman, Noam Chomsky, same thing. They use the same quote. It's about the only quote anybody can find for ownership determining content. This really doesn't happen, particularly in the print media.
We have right now. We have been sold. We were sold a war in Iraq by our media. Right now the crimes
the media
of the Bush administration
opposed the war. I'm not sure quite what you're talking about.
No, the media were cheerleaders for the war. They may be opposing it now, but they were certainly cheerleaders. In 1983, 50 corporations controlled 90% of what everybody sees, hears, or reads. Now, 90% of what everybody sees, hears, or reads is controlled by five huge, arguably six corporations: Time Warner, Disney, News Corp, Bertelsmann, Viacom, and GE.
What percentage of the internet do they own? What percentage of websites do they own? For starters,
what percentage of Americans get their news from the web?
Pardon?
What percentage of Americans get their news from the web?
Of those under 30, about 60.
Of all Americans?
Of those under 30, about 60%.
Okay, and what percentage of the web traffic is, I mean, you know, you've got, the last statistic I saw was that over 25% of all people who were accessing the web were doing through a portal that had to do with AOL Time Warner.
Well, but you're confusing portals and ISPs. An ISP is a gateway. The gateway is irrelevant.
So
the
if
portal,
we end up with a situation where like we have here where Comcast says we're going to throttle back your access to websites that we don't like and allow you to access websites you do because we're now a monopoly, you have no problem with that.
Who's proposing that?
It was done last month by Comcast.
The nature of the internet makes it impossible to do that, even if you wanted to. I'm not. You're presumably talking about net neutrality, but that has nothing to do with...
Well, if you're saying that the net is the salvation of this, and you're opposed to net neutrality as well, well, people can read all about it. You've written about it over at CEI.org. Eli Lehrer, Senior Fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the Libertarian Think Tank. Eli, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you very much.
16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Put this issue of media consolidation and whether or not, broadly speaking, the media is, quote, doing its job, end quote, which presumably we should be demanding, which is giving us news as opposed to infotainment, in the biggest frame possible, in the biggest context possible, in 1835, 52 years after the end of the American Revolution, 42 years after the French Revolution, Alexis de Tocqueville published a book called Democracy in America. He had come over here in 1831, in May of 1831, and traveled around the United States. He was a young French nobleman. He was in his early 30s. And he wrote a book which became, along with Uncle Tom's Cabin, one of the two best-selling books of the entire first half of the 19th century, from 1800 to 1860, arguably one of the arguably the best-selling book of the entire 19th century, Democracy in America. It's still in print. And in that book, he wraps that book up with a chapter that is titled, and this is literally the title of the chapter, Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, What Sort of Despotism Democratic Nations Have to Fear. Now, keep in mind, at that time, there was only a handful of, you could count on one hand, the number of countries that were democratic, small d democratic. And so I am quoting from the 1869 edition published in the United States of de Tocqueville's book. He said, it would seem that if despotism were to be established amongst the democratic nations of our days, it would assume a different character. It would be a more extensive and more mild. It would degrade men without tormenting them. I'm trying myself. Now, here he is. He's looking into a time machine. He's saying, what would bring down a country like America? And he's really struggling because he doesn't have words for it. He says, I am trying myself to choose an expression which will accurately convey the whole of the idea I've formed of it, but in vain. The old words, despotism and tyranny, are inappropriate. He's talking about what he sees that could bring down a democracy. He said, the thing itself is new, and since I cannot name it, I must attempt to define it. The first thing that strikes the observation is an innumerable multitude of men, all equal and alike, incessantly endeavoring to procure the petty and paltry pleasures with which they glut their lives, each of them living apart. And just imagine, all these people all over the country sitting in front of their TV sets, each of them living apart, is as a stranger to the fate of all the rest. His children and his private friends constitute to him the whole of mankind. As for the rest of his fellow citizens, he is close to them, but he sees them not. He touches them, but he feels them not. He exists, but in himself and for himself alone. And if his kindred shall remain to him, he may be said at any rate to have lost his country. This is written in 1831, Alexis de Tocqueville, predicting this power. He says, and what was it that would do this despotism? He says, it's the sort of perpetual gratification that keeps people happy. Again, quoting de Tocqueville, above this race of men stands an immense and tutelary power, a caregiving power, which takes upon itself alone to secure their gratification and to watch over their fate. That power is absolute, minute, regular, provident, and mild. It would be like the authority of a parent if, like that authority, its object was to prepare men for manhood, but it seeks, on the contrary, to keep them in perpetual childhood. It is well content that the people should rejoice, providing they think of nothing but rejoicing. Thus, it every day renders the exercise of the free agency of man less useful and less frequent. It circumscribes them well within a narrow range and gradually robs a man of all the uses of himself. It has predisposed men to endure them. And then he says, after having thus successively taken each member of the community in its powerful grasp and fashioned him at will, this supreme power then extends its arm over the whole community. The will of man is not shattered, but softened and bent and guided. Men are seldom forced to act, but they are constantly restrained from acting. Such a power does not destroy, but it prevents existence. It does not tyrannize, but it compresses, enervates, extinguishes, and stupefies a people till the nation is reduced to nothing better than a flock of timid and industrious animals. What would this be in de Tocqueville's mind? Well, he went on to say, again quoting from this chapter, what despotism... The chapter of the book, Democracy, from the book Democracy in America, the chapter titled, What Sort of Despotism Democratic Nations Have to Fear, he wraps up the chapter saying, I think that men living in aristocracies may, strictly speaking, do without the liberty of the press. But such is not the case with those who live in democratic countries. Servitude cannot be complete if the press is free. The press, a free press, is the chief democratic instrument of freedom. Now, keep in mind, this is coming from a guy who, those of you who have read Democracy in America know what I'm talking about. This is coming from a guy who was actually very skeptical about the possibility of small-d democracy surviving. Because, in part, he saw the rise of essentially what today we would call corporate power, what he referred to in his day as landed wealth, as inherited wealth, because the corporate form wasn't as fully developed in 1836 as it is today. But he saw the acquisition of all this power to take over the media and thus gently control us all. In 1836! By the way, those quotes are all in my book, Unequal Protection. That's what I was reading it from. When I was writing the book is when I read Democracy in America. This is back 6-8 years ago. It just, my jaw dropped when I read that chapter in Democracy in America by Alexis de Tocqueville. Here we are, 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
I took a walk in the rain one day on the wrong side of the tracks. I stood on the rail till I saw that train just to see how my heart would react. Now some people say that you shouldn't tempt fate, and for them I cannot disagree. But I never learned nothing from playing it safe. I said fate should not tempt me. I take my chances.
So you go over to www.theyrule.net, theyrule.net, they rule, as in they rule over us, .net. And load a map There's a bunch of different maps that you can load that other people have created. This one, there are six of the board members of the New York Times. They sit on 13 of the top 500 companies in the U.S. And it's really interesting. You just draw up the New York Times, and for example, Henry Schott is on the board. He's also on the board of Lucent Technologies, Alcoa, and Johnson & Johnson. And you can click there and search for stories on those companies. Brenda Barnes is on the board of the New York Times, and she's also on the board of Sears Roebuck, Pepsi America, Avon Products, and Staples. Ellen Harriman on Eli Lilly and Ford Motor. William Kennard on Nextel Communications. Donald Stewart on Campbell's Soup. John Akers and Lehman Brothers Holdings and PepsiCo. And you can check out, you know, what's the coverage like of these companies that just happen to have these guys as boards of directors. And frankly, as in my book, Unequal Protection, I start out at AT&T and end up at AT&T and go through something like 60 or 70 companies, this giant loop, and you find that basically the Fortune 500, it's all, you know, it's an old boys club. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. David in Seattle. Dave. Hey, Dave, what's up?
How's it going, man?
I'm here.
Well, a quick couple of points I wanted to make is, one, I totally agree with you on the whole media thing. A lot of the media is, or the media reminds me a lot of the major power companies like PUD and PG&E. And you don't have a lot of different options when it comes to that, do you?
No, what I find is particularly interesting is that Kevin Martin, this kid who's the Republican chairman of the FCC, has been talking over the last couple of days, although he's been conspicuously silent since he got slapped down, and I don't think he's going to continue with it, but has been talking about regulating cable companies, because the law says that when 70% of Americans are subscribed to cable and have access to it, and when 70% are subscribed, then the FCC can assert authority over them. And he's saying, you know, wouldn't it be better for consumers if you could say to the cable company, since cable's a monopoly by and large, I mean, there's only one cable wire coming into my house, and I only have one choice, if you could say to the cable company, okay, I'll take MSNBC, but I don't want the five that go along with it. I don't need Fox, thank you very much. I'll take, HBO, but I don't need Showtime, you know, whatever. You know, a la carte pricing rather than these package deals. And the cable companies are fighting it like crazy because it'll hurt their profits. And he's the Republican. He's all in favor of the same company owning the newspaper, the TV station, the radio station, but he is in favor of regulating cable company. I just find that very odd. Maybe they haven't been greasing his palms enough, or maybe he's planning a job when he leaves the FCC. Well, most of these guys with the FCC, after they leave the FCC, or at least most of the Republicans, end up with huge jobs like Colin Powell's son right now. He's got this, you know, very, very well-paid job with a major media consulting and lobbying firm. Gee, what a surprise. So they're looking at, you know, $500,000 a year salaries when they leave. So, of course, they know which side their bread is buttered on.
Exactly. And a lot of these media sources, they don't, you know, they don't have moral obligation to justice and the truth and everything. They just want to fill their pockets. So they're going to just do what it takes to make their money. They don't care about what's really going on in the world. And a lot of people nowadays, the biggest problem with our country is people have no moral fiber anymore. No one really cares.
I think the biggest problem with our country right now, Dave, is that people don't have any clue about what's going on. And I lay that at the feet of these giant monopolies. But your point's well made, and thank you for the call. Gene in Napa. Hey, California. Gene?
Hi. I disagree with caller Mo last hour. He seemed to be defining freedom as the corporate news media, in the corporate news media, as freedom to limit, even censor, the reporting of current events. I disagree, because freedom multiplies the number of voices heard. It never limits them. Most talking about unfreedom of the press, in my view.
Well, he was putting forward the libertarian argument, and the libertarian argument suggests that any regulation, any limitation of corporate behavior, of business behavior, is a limitation of freedom. And I would submit to you that there are many limitations of business behavior that actually enhance freedom, and this is one of them.
There's also a flip side to this Bush FCC move to let the corporations consolidate further.
Mm-hmm.
The FCC has also clamped down on small broadcasters and won't let alternative voices use the airwaves. They won't okay new affordable licenses for small local broadcasters. So that's the flip side. So it's a double pronged attack.
Well, and it's a real odd, strange collection of bedfellows. You know who one of the largest lobbyists is against low power FM stations for local communities?
Mm-mm.
The public broadcasting.
Oh my God.
Yeah, because you know they see it as a direct challenge to what they're doing. You know, it's yeah. So.
Very.
Yeah, so there you go. Anyhow, Gene, thanks a lot for the call. Quinn in Sunnyvale, California. Hey, Quinn, what's up?
Well, you know, you have great guests, and I love that you bring these guests that, you know, often disagree with your own viewpoints. But the thing that I found so difficult about listening to it was, you know, you could argue all day and all night about whether it's right or wrong for, you know, ownership to dictate content, but to argue if it happens or not is absurd because it's such a part of our everyday lives. I remember... you know, before the dot-com bust, Good Morning America had the Pets.com dog on their show, and conveniently enough, a week later they found out that, oh, ABC and Pets.com both have the same parent company.
Yeah, yeah, what a surprise. And the, you know, now it's the movie things that's interrelated. Or there's the famous case of Jane Akers and Steve Wilson down in Florida who were working for a Fox station, and they were reporting on Monsanto, and I think you might have mentioned this to Lauren. But this is the absolute emblematic thing that they RGBH and Monsanto, and they came up with a story that raised some questions about this product, but there's recombinant bovine growth hormone, this new genetically modified hormone that was being given to cows. They rewrote their story dozens of times, trying to make it more and more palatable to their corporate owner. They were told finally to lie in the story. At that point, they said, no, we will not do that. They were fired. They sued Fox for illegal termination of employment, inappropriate termination of employment. A jury of their peers in the state of Florida unanimously found on their behalf and awarded them $250,000 plus severance. And then Fox appealed that to a federal appeals court, and the federal appeals court said, no, the First Amendment gives a corporation the absolute right to lie and to force its employees to lie, and if those employees don't want to report the news the way the corporation wants it reported, and the corporation happens to be the vehicle through which the news is reported, then the corporation has every right to fire those employees. And that's where it stands right now. That's the precedent.
Right, and I mean, even for press media, though, it's also... the idea that, you know, the editor-in-chief controls the content, but who appoints the editor-in-chief? It's the board of directors or, you know, the corporation that's choosing it, and they're going to be picking someone who's going to be in the same lines of ideals as them as well.
Right. Yeah, it's having to, it's the old, you know, I know which side my bread is buttered on thing. Quinn, thanks for the call. Lynn in San Jose. Hey, Lynn.
Hi. You know, that one caller who was talking about getting his information off the computers. Well, I'm not under 30, I'm over 60, and I have a computer, but I still prefer my news coming in on the newspaper while I have my morning coffee. And then what I was calling about is how the media in Bush's first election downplayed the voter manipulation in Florida, and I think that, okay, then they got gutsy enough to where in the second election they took it a little further, and up in Ohio those people were voting, what, at 2 in the morning?
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't hear a heck of a lot about that in the media.
Yep.
And then what really scares me is, okay, how brave are they? Are we going to wake up after the next election and find out that Giuliani's president?
Yeah, I mean, we've had two stolen elections here, and it's time to talk about it and call it exactly what it is and get out there and say it. I don't know, Lynn, and that's why I think it's so important that we get out there and that we get active and that we get organized. And as well as being active and organized around the issue of private corporations owning our vote, which they will for about 80% of us in this coming election. And we just have to work as hard as we can to make that as transparent as we can. I mean, that's just the bottom line. By the way, this is where I see the web going. If net neutrality is done away with, if ISPs are allowed to say, okay, we're going to meter the amount of traffic to your website, and you're going to pay based on that amount of traffic rather than based on the amount of storage space that you have, and so the very popular websites end up having to spend, and it ends up being very, very expensive to host a very popular website. Guess who's going to end up owning the very popular liberal websites, or for that matter, the conservative websites if they're not already owned by them. I mean, you're going to end up with the only players who are able to play in that world are going to be the big corporations, or the small organizations that are highly successful are going to become big corporations. And you're going to end up with you say, well, you know, okay, we've got corporate news on radio, corporate news on television, corporate news in the newspaper now. It's not corporate news on the web, but without net neutrality, which is essentially the same thing as undoing Clinton's Telecommunications Act of 96 and undoing Reagan's doing away with the Fairness Doctrine. We used to have news neutrality. Without net neutrality, the net is going to become just as corporate as everything else. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Corey owns one half of this whole town with political connections to spread his wealth around. Born into society, a banker's only child, he had everything a man could want, power, grace, and style. But I work in his factory, and I curse the life I'm living, and I curse my poverty, and I wish that I could be, oh, I wish that I could be, oh, I wish that I could be Richard Corey.
Actually, I'll pass. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hello. In the chutzpah department, the White House wins it all. Yesterday, the president accused, or the president didn't directly, but the Bush administration accused the Democrats not passing the funding bill of hurting military families and talking about closing child care centers and career centers. This is at the exact same time that the U.S. military is demanding that signing bonuses be returned for U.S. military who have been injured, who cannot complete their tour of duty because they have been injured.
Right. This is absolutely nuts. I'm curious, Ellen, yesterday Scott McClellan released this piece from his book, which is coming out in April. And this is not something you do if you have a book coming out in April. You don't release 6 months in advance a blurb from it. You do that a month in advance or 2 months in advance at the most. This seems to me, you know, clearly a shot across the bow of George W. Bush, saying that Bush himself was involved in the cover-up of what his father referred to as treason, and for which Scooter Libby was actually convicted of several different felonies. This is not being covered. You know, Chris Matthews covered it for an entire hour last night. Keith Olbermann started out with it. It was covered in cable news. It's being covered on the radio. But it's not in the New York Times. It's not in the L.A. Times. It's not in the Washington Post.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news here, but I completely understand why the newspapers are not doing a whole lot of coverage of it. And that is because it was a leak, and we don't know what exists on the two, three paragraphs before and two, three paragraphs afterwards in terms of their, and I'm not saying they're correct, but in terms of their journalistic standards. They can't really get an on-the-record comment from McClellan on this. They can't do an interview. It'd be very difficult by their standards, the way they do newspapers, to cover it. But I do want to say something else on this, which is that Mike Huckabee, who is going up in the polls in Iowa and up in the polls in Iowa, said that he thinks that the president should respond to it. And he said because the closeness and the fact that Scott McClellan was one of his most trusted aides and in the position of press secretary. And he said had this been somebody very distant in the food chain, he could have ignored it. But you can't ignore it when somebody as close to the president as press secretary makes that kind of allegation.
Yeah,
now, that coming from a Republican is really quite amazing.
Yeah, I saw him make that comment last night on Chris Matthews' show on Hardball. And it's on the other hand, he was there. I mean, it was a deer in headlights moment. Yeah, I don't think Mike Huckabee had any idea that that's what he was going to get hit with when he came on. But, he's going up in the polls because he's the outsider. I really think this is the Nixon moment. The newspapers weren't able to interview John Dean after he made his statement to Congress. I mean,
I think what needs to happen is there needs to be a lot of people's energy, comments, pressure in Congress to open up Fitzgerald, get Fitzgerald in there, put Scott McClellan under oath, and make sure that this gets reopened. That's what I think needs to happen.
Yeah, I think this is the smoking gun that can bring this whole thing down, crashing around their heads. It's absolutely, this has got to be it. Anyhow, what else is going on in Washington?
Okay, the Annapolis Peace Conference is sort of next on the hit parade. It looks as if the president tried to invite several people, including the Saudi foreign minister. And I got to tell you, the Saudi foreign minister is one smart cookie. I've met him. I've actually been in his living room in Saudi Arabia. And he is not really willing to participate unless he gets some concessions ahead of time. A lot from the Israelis on the issue of the settlements. Also, I'm just at the United Nations as we speak. The Secretary General is invited, asked about some of the conditions and concerns that they have, particularly access and freedom in and out of Gaza, which has been a big concern of the Secretary General of the United Nations. We were told today that he's basically an invited guest, and he has very little to do with the agenda or what gets on it. So,
Ban Ki-moon?
Ban Ki-moon.
Huh.
So who's
running this thing if the Secretary General of the UN is the invited guest? Is
well, who's running it essentially is the Bush administration and Condoleezza Rice. They are setting the agenda. There's a group of, I think I told you a couple weeks ago, of clergy, all kinds, Muslim, Jewish, and Christian, from the Holy Land, from Israel, and the parts around there. And they have been concerned that Jerusalem is not on the table at this issue, at this conference. And they have objected to that, but they were told, sorry, Jerusalem's not on the table.
You mean
East
Jerusalem?
So we haven't been told the agenda, but clearly it is not exactly open to world opinion or input.
Yeah. By Jerusalem, you're talking about East Jerusalem and the claim that
that
the Palestinians have laid to it. They
right.
want that to be their capital. Yeah, interesting. Oh, man. Do you think that the Democrats are going to flinch on this? You know, Jack Murtha pushing back really, really hard and really loud yesterday against Bush. But still, you know, when 300,000 people or 200,000 people get letters saying that they're going to be laid off by Christmas if Congress doesn't do something.
Well, that's just a tactic, as you know. And as Murtha said yesterday, Obi said it yesterday, the money is available and then some. All the president needs to do is to call Senate Republican Mitch McConnell and say, Mitch, let it come to me. The number is 202-224-2541. I thought that was hilarious. But
yeah.
I think that if the Democrats can keep it up during the Thanksgiving recess with their local electorate and really let them know what's happening, then this will not turn around, as the Republicans can often turn things around very, very very talented way.
Right, which means that this is a great time for, as a brilliant caller to my show here earlier said, for us to be the media. That is, over the Thanksgiving table, as you're getting together with friends and family, tell them what's going on in the world, inform them of what's going on, and if your local elected representatives are having meetings, show up and tell them what you think about this stuff.
One last thing, play the game on freerice.com, and it will help feed children to the World Food Program.
The website again?
Freerice.com.
Freerice.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program, 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Has the dam broke? And I mean that in the non-obscene sense. Has the dam... How many leaks are there in this thing? I mean, there are websites out there chronicling the crimes of the Bush administration that have a list of over 150 of them. There's the obvious ones. There's the obvious and fairly easy to compile short list. You know, the summary execution of willful killings of people, assassinations, lying us into wars, caging over a million votes, corrupting our electoral process, violations of the Presidential Records Act. This is a felony. The RNC emails that are supposed to be supplied to Congress, they're supposed to keep these things. They didn't. They set up this whole parallel system through the RNC. Wireless wiretaps, extraordinary rendition and torture, kidnapping people, including American citizens, kidnapping people and taking them to places where they are tortured, in many cases where they vanish, in many cases where they die, in over 30 cases that we know of where they died, violating habeas corpus, for that matter, doing away with habeas corpus. Oh, it's only been around since 1015. I mean, you know, we don't need that. Since King John and in Runnymede, I mean, habeas corpus, the right to, if you are grabbed and snatched and thrown into prison, the right to be charged with a crime and confront your accuser and present evidence on your own behalf. Torture at home and overseas. Crimes against U.S. and international law. I mean, Sarah Taylor, Karl Rove, violations of the Hatch Act. It just goes on and on and on. Where does it end? Are we seeing the breakdown of this in Scott McClellan's coming out and saying, well, here's the deal, guys. You know, among the liars of that of the outing of the CIA officer, of Valerie Plame, among them.
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Mm-hmm. Scotty saying that when Scotty said that, he was lying. And he was lying because he'd been lied to by George. So apparently George was lying to us, too. Where is the media that can put two and two together? 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Hey, Dave in Philadelphia, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Great show. You know, I used to blame the media for being politically jaundiced, but now more and more I begin to think it's just out in that stupidity. Here in Pennsylvania, only one newspaper ran the McClellan story on the front page today, and that was the Scranton Times. The story did move on the AP wire about 4 or 5 yesterday afternoon, so there's no excuse for it. What I found here in Pennsylvania's capital, the paper did not even run the story at all. So right. I called them. I get some well-meaning desk editor who is mystified by the fact that it's not even in the paper. So I urge people, call your newspapers, because lots of times the paper is at the mercy of what's on the wire and what's not. But call these papers, call these radio stations and say, hey, where's the story? Because right. they need to hear this. Because I really believe that they're not even paying attention a lot of times. So please, like you say, be the media. Call your newspaper, call your radio station, call your local TV station that's too busy doing the story on how to cook the Thanksgiving turkey to even wrap its head around this material.
There you go. Well said, Dave. Back to Alexis de Tocqueville. Let me just share this. This is from Chapter 11 of his book, Democracy in America. And he's talking about how concentration of the media, this is specifically, it's an entire chapter about the media, Chapter 11. It's Liberty of the Press in the United States. And he's talking about how concentration in the media produces despotism. He says it's been demonstrated by observation and discovered by the sheer instinct, even of the pettiest despots, that the influence of a power is increased in proportion that its direction is centralized. In France, the press combines a twofold centralization. Almost all of its power is centered in the same spot, and so to speak, in the same hands, for its organs are far from numerous. The influence upon a skeptical nation of a public press thus constituted must be almost unbounded. Now, as he's saying, the French press, this is in 1835, had tremendous power over the people because it was highly centralized. He said, it is an enemy with whom a government may sign an occasional truce, but which it is difficult to resist for any length of time. Neither of these kinds of centralization exists in America. And then he goes through why, you know, that we're a large agrarian state and all this kind of thing. He says, the consequence is that nothing is easier than to set up a newspaper, as a small number of subscribers suffices to defray the expenses. Hence, the number of periodical and semi-periodical publications in the United States is almost incredibly large. The most enlightened Americans attribute the little influence of the press to this excessive dissemination of its power. And it's an axiom of political science in that country, in the United States, that the way to neutralize the effect of the public journals, in other words, to prevent any one media outlet from having power over the people, that the way to neutralize the effect of the public journals is to multiply their number. I cannot see how a truth which is so self-evident would not already have been more generally admitted in Europe. Right. Caleb in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Caleb.
Hey, what a super show.
Thank you.
And, you know, one of the things I've been interested in for well over a decade is a menu of courses. Let's say for television, you know, for cable access. Then I could watch what Tom Hartman watches. That is on maybe, you know, I want to subscribe to the Tom Hartman menu, and therefore I get the channels you get, and also I get on certain major channels maybe the shows you want to watch.
You mean like over on iTunes and on Amazon and other sites as well where I can put up my list of my favorite songs or
right.
a list of my favorite books, and you can say, yeah, I like that list. You know, it's
but fact, but also would come into the television station, and I wouldn't have to say, gee, am I going to learn about Anna Nicole Smith or one of these other things?
Right.
It would block the fire hose of stuff, crud that comes into our houses.
Well, absolutely. If we had a la carte pricing
for cable
channels, you would see a whole lot more. Frankly, I think you'd see a whole lot more news, and you know, a lot
right.
of people just signing up to be able to watch Amy Goodman, for example, you know, and that kind of thing. No,
well,
absolutely.
Keith Olbermann,
and Keith Olbermann as well. Caleb, well said. Thank you very much, Paul. And you'd also be looking at a lot of people. I know Caleb does a local cable show here in Portland, I believe. And you'd be looking for more of that kind of stuff. Paul in Detroit, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Paul.
Long live our republic, Tom.
Amen.
I'm not scared, but I got a nice fire in my gut. I think the media monopolies are manipulating the voters, not by what we're being told by, but by what we're not.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, to Tocqueville, he says, in America, there's scarcely a hamlet that has not its own newspaper. It may readily be imagined that neither discipline nor unity of action can be established among so many combatants, and each one consequently fights under his own standard. See, that was back in the day when there were a zillion newspapers, and no newspaper had the power to withhold or direct attention in a particular direction or withhold it from another direction. That's not the case now.
Okay, two things. Number one. A friend of mine asked Mr. Conyers if impeaching Cheney, about impeaching Cheney, and was told, you don't understand why we can't impeach him. Not a direct quote, of course. I respect Mr. Conyers' record, and I'm not politically savvy. My question is, considering the statute of limitations and people like Ollie North and whatnot, would it be preferable for the Democrats to indict members of the Bush administration after Bush doesn't have the power to pardon anybody?
No, because the day that Bush leaves office, everybody's going to move on. And they're going to want to move on. It's going to be the long national nightmare is over, even if it's a Republican who is president, and even if it's Mike Huckabee, for example, who I'm increasingly thinking actually has a solid chance. And people are going to want to move on. They're going to want to say, no, we've had enough of this. You know, these guys... And there will be no taste for it. There'll be as hard as impeachment is now, indictment will be harder after the fact. Bob in New York City. Hey, Bob.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you that the media is controlled only by a handful of corporations. But one scandal that the media is trying to suppress is the fact that AIPAC was caught spying in the Pentagon. Okay, no one wants to talk about that.
I think that was fairly widely reported at the time.
Widely reported?
Well, okay, maybe not. I don't know.
I don't know.
Jeff in Denver. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. Really glad you're coming to Tocqueville right now. And
yeah.
We
need to wrap it up really quick here, Jeff.
Okay. So. Anyway, we have a leaders list industry. The media just looks at all the other media. Radio, all the rags are about other radio stations. They only do things if other media does it.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
And they're copying each other. It's kind of like masturbating there.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. Thank you, Jim. By the way, I don't think it was AIPAC. I think it was Israel. But 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the Chinese. You blew the budget and you bought Iraq. So I'm taking my
yes, indeed, my friends, taking our country back one congressional district at a time. It's election season. Nancy Skidder is with us, my old friend. We used to actually be together on the IE America Radio Network years ago. She is now running for Congress in Michigan's 9th District, U.S. House of Representatives, against Joe Nolenberg. Skinner for Congress, Skinner spelled just as you might think, S-K-I-N-N-E-R, Skinner for F-O-R, Congress.com, her website. Nancy Skinner, welcome to the program.
Tom Hartman, my friend, how are you?
I am just great. It's so nice to hear your voice, Nancy. Tell us how your campaign's going. How is everything going there in Michigan?
Well, Michigan is in rough straits right now. We have a 7.7% unemployment rate, 83% wrong track numbers in our polling. So the state is not doing too well with the auto industry in decline.
I know my family's all from there. In fact, I'll be back there in 2 weeks to visit my mother and my brothers. And it is tough times. But I would think that, you know, you're running against a Republican who has been kind of Mr. Bush all the way, hasn't he?
Oh, absolutely, Joe Nolenberg, and you know, especially the issue of the auto industry. You know, Tom, I believe I started out this whole odyssey of being on progressive on radio. Before that, I worked on global warming since 1993 when I read Al Gore's first book, and I just at my website posted about my dismay at the lack of leadership on global warming. But when it affects the auto industry, it's as if, you know, we stick our heads in the ground and say, you know, we can't change, we can't jump and leapfrog to new technologies like hybrids and fuel cells, and it's hurt us economically. It wasn't a wise choice, and so it's confounding to me that so many in Washington and here just accept what the auto industry says, and instead of saying, hey, let's take $20 billion and invest in a whole new generation of technology and leapfrog this industry, that would be the biggest economic boon that could happen here in Michigan and across the country, obviously, if we do it with all renewable energy. But there is a resistance to change that I don't quite understand. But that's
nice
the fight we're fighting.
It's nice, Nancy Skinner, to hear a Democrat talking about that, because, frankly, some of the Democrats from Michigan have been the ones who have been working against in favor of the auto industry, and frankly, I think against the interests of the auto industry long term, but have been working against things like raising CAFE standards.
Absolutely, Tom. And you know what? That is why it matters what kind of Democrats we elect. That
Amen.
We need progressive Democrats. Now, so I ran against Joe Nolenberg last November, and I came, it was the final, was you helped me, and I loved your listeners, were so wonderful to me, but it ended up being 47-51%.
Wow.
I was outspent 7-1.
Wow.
As a progressive Democrat, this guy had 20-point win margins in the last two elections. Everyone thought it was a suicide mission that I should take him on. And this is what I talked about, these issues. I did not shy away.
And you came within 5 points of winning him, and he outspent you 7-1. That's amazing.
So what happens? The DCCC recruits a candidate to run against me in the primary whose campaign slogan is the right kind of change.
Oh, no.
You know what I'm talking about, people?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We've seen this play out before in other districts and other areas. And what happens is we end up with folks in Washington who are more concerned about polling and money and reelection than doing what is right, and the election consequences be damned. You know, if you're going to lose your job because you vote your conscience, so be it. That's my view on it, and we need more people like that in Congress to do it. So, I feel like this is a time that people are starting to wake up to that. Progressives are starting to wake up that it's not just enough to vote Democratic, that we need really dedicated votes of conscience in there. We need good, strong progressives in there, and Russ Feingold is, you know, others are out there fighting the good fight, but they need more of us.
And what's so amazing, what just boggles my mind about the decisions that the DCCC and the DLC and the Rahm Emanuels of the world keep making, is that when they put milquetoast Democrats up against Republicans, they have to spend to death to get within spitting distance of the Republicans or to win. Whereas when they put real progressives in, I mean, you know, the governor of Montana is probably one of the best examples, Brian Schweitzer. But when you put a real progressive in against a Republican of any variety, they win easily. Or as in your case, I mean, outspent 7-1, and you nearly got it. So this is why it's so important for us all to be supporting progressive Democrats, not just Democrats, but progressive Democrats like Nancy Skinner at SkinnerForCongress.com, and good post on global warming today, by the way. Final thoughts, Nancy? We've got about 30 seconds.
Final thoughts. Catch me on Fox News today. I'm going to debate Steve Forbes on the economy. He says that the recession, the average person out there really has nothing to worry about in terms of recession or the economy.
Well, you know, speaking as Steve Forbes, after all, he was born with, what, $100 million in his back pocket? I mean,
and Tom, and just anything that anyone can do, $10, $20, $100 to Skinner, you know, and go to my website, that makes a difference. We can speak as a nation about what kind of candidates we want. That's the beauty of what you're doing, and I thank you for your help and your listeners' help.
Well, and thank you, Nancy, for coming back like the Energizer Bunny every couple of years, and or actually, you know, 2 years later here, and running for this seat again. I mean, it's just, it is so important that you're doing it, and this time, you know, we'll get you there. Skinner for Congress, forcongress.com, the website. Thank you, Nancy.
Thanks, Tom Hartman.
27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Through streets paved with gold, lifted some stones, saw the skin and bones of a city without a soul. I went out walking under an atomic sky, where the ground won't turn and the rain it burns like the tears when I said goodbye. Yeah, I went with nothing, nothing but the thought of you. I went wandering.
34 minutes past the hour. Alexis de Tocqueville, 1836. The influence of the liberty of the press does not affect political opinions alone, but extends to all the opinions of men and modifies customs as well as laws. The opening sentence of the chapter. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Matt in Napa, California. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I just want to follow up on the media question a little bit. It seems like you guys are hinting at this, but the question of local media, you know, and what people can do kind of on their own, regardless of not necessarily using the major media. You know, you've mentioned some of it, public access, you know, opening up local newspapers and local radio stations. And I think that type of involvement is a little more on the Jeffersonian model of really, you know, being involved at the local level and not just being a Nielsen statistic of some sort. And so,
And it's ironic, because here I am nationally syndicated, and yet I will be the first to tell you that I absolutely support local radio. And, you know, it hasn't, to the best of my knowledge, it hasn't happened yet in the 6 years we've been doing this show that a station calls up and says, hey, we're going to take you down and put up a local show. But if somebody did, I would not say, oh, no, don't do that. I would say I support that.
Right. To follow up a little bit, you know, of course, we do need some sort of national media for the local media to work, and that is where, you know, the questions become really important that we leave that open, because if we do, you know, we do need something to base
on. Yeah, I should add, by the way, in the context of local, that I also do a local show here in Portland, Oregon. I do the third hour of a three-hour local show. For the last 2 years, I did the entire 3 hours, and now Carl Wolfson and Heidi Tauber do the first 2 hours themselves alone, and or, you know, without me, and I join for the third hour. So I'm participating in local media as well.
Can I make one last suggestion?
Yeah, go for it, man.
So I really appreciate your point, you know, when you encourage people to participate in the Democratic parties, but you might want to mention, you know, that if you don't first establish a real media network that people can communicate with themselves on a local basis, that, you know, just being at the Democratic Party is maybe not the first step. Maybe the first step really should be to go out and establish that local community network.
And I would make that local network an in-person, in-your-face network. I don't mean in-your-face in a negative way, but like, you know, Drinking Liberally, for example, is an amazing group. I spoke to a Drinking Liberally group in New York City about, 2-3 months ago when Leo DiCaprio's movie came out. We did a screening of the movie for them. And there's one here in Portland that meets, you know, and it's what a great way to get together, you know. And then, of course, there's like Democracy for America. There are meetup groups, you know, that evolved out of the Dean for America campaign, but now they're doing trainings and things. There are meetup groups. There are Democratic meetup groups, green meetup groups all over. Matt, well said. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Lonnie in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Lonnie.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. And, you know, I I'm a bit cynical, but this whole thing about Scott McClellan's book coming out just as it does, where he's pointing the finger directly at the White House, I couldn't stop thinking about it all night. And I'll tell you the truth, it makes me wonder if it's not going to be used as a political ploy by the Republicans to wrestle the impeachment issue away from the Democrats, because the Democrats are so afraid of it. We have a year left before the election, and it occurred to me that with this book, with straight out information, if the Republicans will figure out a way to like wrestle the issue away and say, see those Democrats, they're afraid to uphold our Constitution and Scott McClellan's.
You mean the Republicans would go ahead and try to impeach Bush?
Yeah, because let's face it, they don't have a chance in, you know, where to get, unless they're going to...
Well, but, you know, Lonnie, I don't think that we'll see that happen. In fact, I guarantee you won't see that happen. However, you're on to something, and that is that the Republicans are going to use this, and Mike Huckabee did it yesterday on Chris Matthews' show Hardball. The Republicans are going to use, the smart Republicans are going to use this to distance themselves as fast and as far as they can from George W. Bush. You know, spot on that. You're absolutely right in that regard. Thank you for the call. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice.
Hi. I'm calling in regard to Bob Novak, and I'm amazed that months ago he in his column outed Brewster Jennings possibly putting lives at risk. That evening, Keith Olbermann called him a traitor, and when the first President Bush ran the CIA, he defined such an act as traitorous, and yet nothing's ever been done to Bob Novak.
I agree. I'm astounded by it as well. And the answer to that is, I believe, found in Patrick Fitzgerald's comment that Scooter Libby, by obstructing justice, a crime for which he was convicted by a jury of his peers, by obstructing justice, quote, threw sand in the umpire's face, end quote. In other words, made it impossible, created a this cloud over the vice presidency, but made it impossible for Fitzgerald to actually get through to the truth. And because Scooter Libby refused to testify truthfully. And because Scooter Libby lied on the stand, lied before a grand jury, lied under oath, and was convicted of it, George W. Bush rewarded him by making sure that he'll never see a day in jail. And his friends rewarded him by putting together a multi-million-dollar legal defense fund. And you know, you can guarantee you, Scooter Libby is set for life. Weird little Scooter with his strange novels and all this stuff. I mean, it's, yeah, I enough of the rant. Ned in Pasadena, California. Hey, Ned.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to follow up on your idea of us becoming the media and, you know, trying to hold our congresspeople accountable on things like impeachment. I would like to suggest going an additional step, and it also has to do with the media because it's something that I did. I had gone the usual route of calling my congressman, writing my congressman, in fact, meeting with my congressman in his office, and got unsatisfactory responses about impeachment. He seemed to drag his feet and make a lot of excuses. Finally, he had a big public meeting, and he made the same excuses to 100-plus people. And I was so fed up, I thought, you know, I'm going to write an opinion piece for my local weekly paper, which I did and got it published, calling for the impeachment of George Bush on the torture issue. I could have, of course, multiplied that by many other issues that you've outlined so well today. I would encourage people to put their congressman on record in the public prints, whether it's through a letter to the editor or an opinion piece, which you can get into smaller weeklies like the Pasadena Weekly, because otherwise your opinion can just go down a black hole.
Yeah, well said. We need to be in their faces. We need to let them know what we're thinking. We need to be there repeatedly. And frankly, if they are not, I'm not an advocate of single-issue politics. I think it's a mistake to say, okay, this guy's wrong on impeachment, therefore I'm going to support his challenger or her challenger in the primary. But when you have an aggregation of issues, I mean, there's got to be some kind of a tipping point. There's some big ones there. You know, did they support things like the new bankruptcy bill that's going to screw the average American? Are they supporting the so-called free trade, you know, the corporate trade agreements? Are they, you know, the NAFTA and CAFTA and Peru and whatnot? Where do they stand on Medicare? You know, inform yourself about the major issues, you know, in particular the Military Commissions Act and the war in Iraq. How are they, and if they're not in sync with you on these positions, and they have a primary challenger, send that challenger money. Ron in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ron.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I have earlier somebody made a comment, and I just want to go back to it quickly about the signing bonus issue with the military.
Right.
My question is this, and I may have just missed this, but when people sign up for our volunteer military and they cut some sort of deal for where they're going to be and what their service is going to be, was this part of that agreement? Did they sign an agreement that essentially said if you come back wounded or with some sort of injury that is, you know, fairly serious, that you are going to have to give back the money? Or is that not, it seems to me like this should be a very simple issue. It's either in the paperwork or it's not in the paperwork, and I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer either, but I would, you know, bet just about any amount of money that it is in the contract, but it's not in the contract in a way that would make sense to the average high school graduate who's signing up, but would make perfect sense to a lawyer.
You make a good point there.
That you know, it's probably a 10-page fine print contract, and there's probably a phrase in there that says, if you are for any reason unable to serve out the time, then you have to repay the, you know, blah, 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 blah. And people look at that, and or it might even be explained to them by a recruiter who says, you know, hey, if we throw you out or you're insubordinate or something, we don't have to pay you for the rest of the time. So, you know, follow orders. I mean, it could even be turned as a kind of a positive, not a positive, but, you know, as a reasonable thing.
Yeah, I just, you know, I'm bothered when things aren't precise and you're talking about the media and so forth. So I'm it's kind of stuck in my ear that let's make sure we're not just talking about the government scroging somebody, but that really there was an agreement and there's a quid pro quo between these two. One other quick note about the media conglomeration and all that. I started out in small town radio a million years ago and eventually got out of that world, but you know, I remember even at that time the, you know, things were starting to become, you know, little stations were owned by bigger companies and bigger and bigger and bigger, and the same thing with newspapers now. And my worry is that there's essentially no training ground, let's put the bloggers and the internet aside, but when it
there's
comes
no
to
farm team for radio,
you know, traditional, there's no training ground for young people in radio, in television, and newspapers, because these papers are all owned by these large groups, and they, you know, there's maybe one reporter covering a huge area.
Yeah, we're losing.
We're going to lose a whole generation of people that aren't going to know what to do.
You're right, Ron. We're losing an intellectual property, basically, an intellectual commons here. You're absolutely right, and well said. Thank you, Ron. Much appreciated. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
I don't care what the people say.
Well, actually, I'm not. I'm a vegetarian.
I'm a turkey killer.
But apparently he is.
I don't care what the people say. Take your hand off that turkey, boy.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. By the way, just a heads up, November 29th, I'll be in Los Angeles Thursday night, the 29th, 7:30 p.m. at Barnes & Noble on 3rd Street. On Friday night, the 30th, at 7 o'clock, I'll be at the Ventura County Democrats Speakers Series in Oak Park, California. And on December 14th, I'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota at 7 p.m. at the University of Minnesota Bookstore in Kauffman Memorial Union. And we'll be doing our show live from Air America, Minnesota. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Evan in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Evan, welcome to the program.
Hey, my question is, since, you know, about the media consolidation issue, since Air America is not it's not a nonprofit. It's a privately owned corporation. Wouldn't there, I mean, as bad as this potential change in the rules would be, would Air America be in a position to kind of take advantage of that for the purpose of progressive talk radio? I mean,
unlike Rupert Murdoch, who actually owns many of the television stations that, although they're not the TV stations that are carrying Fox News, that's a cable system, but Rupert Murdoch owns TV stations and owns newspapers like the Times of London and I believe it's the New York Post. Air America does not own any of the distribution outlets. Air America is a syndicator, basically. It's we produce programming, and radio stations can carry it or not. It's up to them. It's entirely up to them. The programming is offered to radio stations for free in exchange for their carrying 5 of our network minutes every hour. We sell those 5 advertising minutes, and that's how we make our living. And then, you know, the radio station adds their local minutes, and that's how they make their living. It's a barter business. It's kind of a cool business model, actually. But that's how it works, and it works very, very well in those markets where the radio stations are well managed and they put it on a good stick. It's doing great, and where it doesn't, it can have a challenge. But as is true with any kind of programming, any kind of format. But the bottom line, Evan, Air America doesn't own the radio stations that it's broadcasting on, so it's a whole different thing than GE owning not only NBC but also a lot of the NBC affiliates. Sue in Cypress, California. Hey, Sue.
Yes, you said that 70% of the public subscribes to cable. Well, as you may know, in February 2009, all broadcast TV is required to switch to analog, which means that everybody...
You mean to switch to digital?
Digital, right. Everybody who doesn't already subscribe to cable or satellite will have to do so to receive TV or else buy a special box, converter box for each TV. I think this looks like not only is government in the pocket of the cable and satellite industries, but more sinister, this is going to take effect after the new president and Congress have been inaugurated, so whichever party's in power will get the blame when the average consumer gets the bill for this.
Yeah, I don't see this conversion, Sue, as part of a nasty conspiracy. I see it as an industry-wide upgrade, basically, of technology. On the other hand, to the extent to which it is being used by cable companies, for example, as an excuse to jack up prices because they are monopolies, that's the nasty conspiracy. But the upgrade to digital, is something that really has to be done as the technology changes.
Is there any other way this could be done without requiring the consumer to pony up a lot of extra money?
Sure, they could require the cable companies to pony up the extra money. That's the point. The cable companies are monopolies, and they should be answerable to the people. And that's ultimately what C-SPAN is. All the cable companies kick into the C-SPAN fee and contribute and pay for part of that. And that's their way of serving the public. Back to this idea that the media is here, has an obligation to program in the public interest. And in the case of cable, it's C-SPAN. It's kind of gone by the wayside with radio and television. Catherine in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Catherine.
Hi, Tom. I'm not as politically articulate as all of your callers, but the thing I do is I meditate to try and find some way to wrestle with my frustration. Or as my husband calls it, catnapping. And so I catnapped the other day, and I had this sign of all this broken glass. And I just felt like Nancy Pelosi needs to see what she's doing and who she is. And I know you say that calling them does no good, but...
No, I didn't. I've never said that. I say calling them is a very important thing. The thing that very, very often does no good is trying to email them, because they've all reached the point where they've got spam filters. And the only way that you can generally email a member of Congress is through their website, and you have to have a zip code that's in there, that they actually represent.
Okay.
But if you call them, they will listen to you.
Okay. That's fantastic. But it really helps my frustration with all this political crap.
Yeah.
And I try to leave like the short quippets of little messages. Like the one I left yesterday was, I got your back, you have mine. So impeach Bush.
There you go. Yeah. Tell Nancy Pelosi that we will help her. If she will stand up straight and she'll take them on, we will be there right behind her. We got about 30 seconds left. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. You're gonna have the last word, Armin.
The whole problem where I think we're at is, and I think you'll agree, is there's an economic ruling class that's making the rules. And you always say the rules are what count and what makes the play for everybody else to go by. And
this is why the things like progressive taxation and the Sherman Antitrust Act are so important.
I totally agree with you. But look, Tom, let's deal with reality. Name one candidate that's going to get any airtime, that's going to stand a chance, that's going to come out openly and say, I'm going against the economic ruling class, because until we change that...
John Edwards has already said that. He said he is taking on the big corporations. He's taking on corporate power in the United States. Now, he's not getting a lot of airtime, but he said that. Thursday and Friday, coming up, happy Thanksgiving. It's going to be Tom Hartman Recycled. Coming up Monday, I'll be challenging communist Raymond Latta on his support of bringing the idea of communism into politics today. That and the best of the rest of the news.